Good morning. We're going to go ahead and get started because we have a packed agenda for you. I'm Brenda Carter, and this is Kirk Evans. I'm a principal technical writer in the Office Division.
And I'm an architect with the Azure Modern Apps Center of Excellence within our services organization.
So we're going to talk to you today about putting SharePoint in Windows Azure. We know that there are a lot of questions today about this topic, and so Kirk and I have some crisp guidance for you on what solutions we're recommending for Windows Azure, how to architect those solutions so that they're a good fit in the platform. We also have some prescriptive guidance for you on two solutions: disaster recovery of an on-premises SharePoint farm to Windows Azure, and internet sites. So let's get started. So here's how we're thinking about SharePoint in Windows Azure. On the left of this slide, we've got a list of our solutions that we're recommending for the platform. Dev and test environments, pretty obvious choice. A great place is Windows Azure for those. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about disaster recovery and internet-facing sites. And then this last solution is a great option for our customers who are adopting 365 and Yammer. And this involves putting the directory synchronization server in Windows Azure. So it's a 64-bit server. And some of our customers are a little bit bothered when we tell them that they need to deploy this on-premises. We just released some solution guidance that tells you how to put this in Windows Azure and hook it up. If you have questions about this solution, Reza Ali is the guy to ask. He built the POC of this solution, and he published some great content last week on exactly how to do this. So let's talk about the right side of the slide now. If you are working on collaboration solutions or intranet solutions, here's how we want you to walk this through. We first want you to look at Office 365. This platform excels at these workloads. If this is not a good fit for you, or you can't put everything in Office 365, we next want you to consider a standard architecture on-premise. Our Microsoft Consulting Service offers a standard architecture. I know some of our partners and our MVPs offer standard architectures, and the advantages of these are they take far less time to deploy and they're less expensive. We know that some of our customers need a little bit more complexity, so we absolutely support you in a hybrid environment. You can do some hybrid integration with Office 365 and your farm on-premise. And of course, we always support you if you need a very individualized farm for your environment. Now, this last point is kind of important. If you have business needs that are pointing you towards putting these workloads in the cloud, we welcome you to Windows Azure. And we would rather have you put these workloads in Windows Azure than any other non-Microsoft cloud platform. And the biggest reason for that is because it's going to be a lot easier for us to support you because we understand the stack from top to bottom, unlike Amazon Web Services. So let's get started with our architecture concepts. So we've boiled down the concepts for the SharePoint architect. These are the kind of core things that you need to know. I'm going to be using this reference architecture to have this discussion. It's labeled hybrid on-premises in Azure. The hybrid just refers to that we've extended the on-premises environment out into Windows Azure. It's not hybrid for SharePoint. So this is a reference architecture for our disaster recovery solution. I'm going to talk you through it piece by piece. When we built our proof of concept for our disaster recovery solution, the first thing we did is create the virtual network. This is a container where you define the IP address ranges that you're going to use for your virtual machines. Next, you're going to connect the on-premises environment with that Azure environment by creating the VPN connection. And when you do this, you're going to be configuring an active VPN component in Windows Azure. The thing I want to highlight for you on this slide is that in the background, Windows Azure is configuring and managing a standby VPN connection. You will not see this. It's not visible to you, but I just want to let you know that it's there so you don't have to worry about high availability of this component. So here's where we want you to put a little bit of thinking into the solution: cloud services. So think of a cloud service as a way to group VMs by role based on functionality that takes place at the cloud layer in Windows Azure. So there's a couple things to know. First of all, you can start and stop cloud services together. You can import and export configurations of a cloud service. Cloud services can load balance endpoints for you. So for example, if you have three web servers, the cloud service will load balance that traffic to all three web servers. And then finally, here's a point I kind of want you to understand. Cloud services allow you to auto-scale roles, but this is not supported for SharePoint. You need to kind of go through the traditional process of adding and removing servers from your SharePoint farm. So if you have somebody come to you and say cloud services can be used to auto-scale roles, therefore let's create lots of cloud services, let them know that it's not supported. It's not a good reason to add more cloud services to your design than you need. So we have some best practices around cloud services, and these have kind of surfaced as a result of having conversations with our kind of premier consultants in the field who have a lot of experience with Azure as well as our Azure team. So for SharePoint, we kind of land at three cloud services as a starting point. The kind of the most important thing I've heard from our consultants, and this applies to any SharePoint design activity, is to keep it simple. We would use one cloud service if we could. But we end up with three, so I'll talk you through it. We are putting Active Directory and DNS all in one cloud service, and this is because starting this cloud service first helps with the IP configuration of the rest of the solution. Next, we put those database servers all in a dedicated cloud service, and this is because of a requirement for using the SQL Listener, which is now supported in Azure. And here's a reference for you if you want more information. Essentially, the client application must reside in a different cloud service. So in this case, the SharePoint servers are the client to the SQL Availability Group. And that leaves us with one big cloud service for all the rest of the SharePoint roles. And we're even going to put Office Web Apps in that cloud service too. So that's how to think about cloud services. Now, if you are working on internet-facing scenarios, there are a couple other reasons why you might need one or two more cloud services. I put these in here as a reference for you to look back at. Our session is kind of packed, so I don't want to spend too much time on some of these details, but it's here for you to come back to. So next, we're going to add our Active Directory to this architecture. When you do SharePoint and Azure, you need an Active Directory environment to support you. If you're doing like an internet site, you could have a dedicated Active Directory domain that has no relationship to your on-premises environment. In this case, this is a reference for our disaster recovery solution, and so we do need that connection to the on-premises environment. So we are putting two Active Directory servers, or VMs, in Azure, and we're also sharing the DNS role on those VMs. And this constitutes a hybrid deployment of Active Directory. So I met with our Active Directory team on campus, and we went through our SharePoint scenarios, and we came up with this list of starting point settings or configurations for the Active Directory component of the architecture. This is a reference. These are starting point settings that you can use. The Active Directory team really wants you to look at their content on TechNet, and here's a reference to their article. It's really important to read their article. They have a lot of experience with their product in Azure. So read their content, and then that will help you know if you need to make changes to these starting point kind of reference settings here. So this is the final concept I'm going to talk about with our little tutorial here, availability sets and fault domains. So I would like for you to think about a fault domain in Azure as if it were a rack of servers. So a fault domain is a group of servers that will be updated together, and because they may likely very well be on the same rack, they can go down together. So the way to plan for high availability in Azure is to configure availability sets. So as you can see in this illustration, we've got two of each role, and each of those pairs are configured to be in an availability set. This ensures that Azure does not place both of those VMs on the same rack or in the same fault domain. If you have three VMs in an availability set, Azure guarantees that no more than two of them will be on the same fault domain. So it's important to tune your architecture with the availability sets. And that brings us back to the full-blown architecture. We've talked about all the elements here. When it comes time to deploy the VMs, there are a few more concepts that you need to understand. And Kirk did a great job describing these in a session on Monday. So look back to his session, download the slide deck, and learn more about disk types and endpoints, storage accounts, and affinity groups. And it's a packed session, so there's a lot of good information in there.
And my favorite slide, demo. And if you're interested in the content that we've been talking about, the reference slides and the availability of those, I saw some folks taking pictures. You also have access to this content to download from MySPC from the session, as well as the contents available as an attachment in Yammer as well. So here I am on the Windows Azure Management Portal, and some of the concepts that Brenda talked previously about were affinity group, cloud service, and virtual networks. I'm briefly going to show you these inside the management portal just as to reinforce those concepts. So let's start with the concept of an affinity group. An affinity group makes sure that all of the components that are part of that affinity group are deployed to the same region. And that's important because SharePoint needs all of its SQL databases and the SharePoint servers to be located as closely together. So using an affinity group ensures that any of the entities that are deployed as part of that affinity group are located in the same region as closely together as possible. To do that, we'll go to the settings add-in here on the bottom of the portal. And then we'll go to affinity groups. And to define an affinity group is very easy. We'll just say add. We can give it a name, SPC demo AG. Description, SPC demo, and then we can tell it what region that we want the elements to be deployed to, such as we would like it in Central US, East US, North Europe, West US, so we'll just choose West US and say okay. And that creates very quickly, it just says any elements that participate in this affinity group, we'd like you to be located as closely together. Next, Brenda mentioned about defining the virtual network. So we'll go in and look at networks. And when we create a network, we can simply, again, click the New button. And here's where we have the ability to do things like register a DNS server. We can create a new one, or we can even import an existing configuration. I'll simply choose Custom Create to show you the wizard walkthrough where you can specify settings like SPC Demo VNet. And we can also choose our affinity group. And we'll want to choose the affinity group that we just created a moment ago, the SPC demo AG. Next, we'll say what are our DNS servers. Here is where you'd specify the IP address of either your on-premises DNS server or more likely the DNS server that is in your domain controller that's hosted with your SharePoint virtual machine in Azure. So I already have a domain controller inside Azure, and I could choose that one. And I could also configure connectivity. We have the ability to establish VPN connections, either using site-to-site, which allow any computers to be able to route through that VPN, or you can do a point-to-site. Point-to-site enables anybody who installs an agent to be able to VPN in, similar as when you VPN into your corporate networks. So I will simply choose next. And then we could define address spaces and subnets. So I could add an additional subnets. Maybe I have a subnet for the application layer, a different subnet for SQL, a different subnet for identity layer. I'm gonna cancel out of this one because I already defined one, a VNet called SP Auto VNet. You can see, again, there's my DNS server, and it uses the IP for the domain controller that I just used, and several subnets. I have one for the application layer. I also have one for my domain controller. The next point that Brenda brought up was that of a cloud service. So let's go look at cloud services. Cloud service is, again, the container for the virtual machine. So what we can do is simply say new cloud service. We could do quick create or custom create, SPC demo, CS, Again, use the affinity group that we just created a moment ago, and then we can say OK. I'm not going to click OK just for time's sake, because I've already have one defined. Once you have one defined, now we can go to virtual machines. Say new virtual machine from gallery. And we'll be able to choose from a number of different images, including Oracle. We also have different Linux distributions. And we also have the ability to use some Microsoft-provided images, such as SharePoint. So we'll go into SharePoint, say Next, give it a name, SPC Demo VM1 is fine. Choose a size. And then finally, provide a username. It doesn't like password 1. That's a good thing. We'll do password 2. And we'll go next. And now we can choose either create a new cloud service or use a cloud service that we've already created. So this is how, if you have an existing cloud service deployed, you could add additional virtual machines into that specific cloud service. So I can choose one and then choose the virtual network subnet that this virtual machine will participate in. Again, using the virtual network settings that we just defined a moment ago. And then finally, the concept of an availability set. Availability set provides that fault domain tolerance, and that would allow us then to have two virtual machines, such as two web front ends. Should one go down, the other one would remain running because they would be deployed to two different rack servers because we defined those to participate in an availability set. So that's all I really wanted to show you as a very quick overview demo to reinforce some of the concepts Brenda said. Let's go back and talk a little bit more about disaster recovery.
So I'm going to tell you about disaster recovery. Kirk's going to cover internet sites for us. So there are a few reasons why we feel like Azure is a great fit for a disaster recovery environment. And at the top of the list is cost. We know a lot of our SharePoint customers don't currently have a disaster recovery environment simply because it costs a lot of money to replicate that on-premises farm in a secondary data center. One of the advantages of Azure and any cloud platform is the elasticity, and this can really work in our favor with a disaster recovery environment. So within Azure, you can build a smaller version of your on-premises farm, and then after failover, you can scale that out within the next few hours to meet your target capacity and performance goals. And then finally, Azure's a great hosted secondary data center. You don't need to invest in a data center in another city somewhere else. So when we talk about disaster recovery environments in the industry, we often use the terms hot, warm, and cold. When we take disaster recovery into a cloud platform, these terms might take on slightly different meanings. So I just want to make sure we're all on the same page here. A hot environment is a fully sized farm, provisioned, updated, and ready to go. What we're going to present to you today is a warm environment. We're going to talk about warm environments. This is a very practical solution, taking advantage of the cloud platform. The farm is built and the VMs are ready to go, but it's going to be a little bit of work to fail over, attaching the content databases and kicking off the services. Here's where it can get really good. Obviously, I've just mentioned we can start with a smaller version of the production farm and then scale it out. A cold standby environment is also a compelling solution. Essentially, you build that farm in Windows Azure, and then you shut down the VM, so you're not paying for compute. With a cold environment, you'll still need to bring those VMs up every once in a while to patch and update those, make sure the environment's healthy. And then it's a little bit more work after failover to get the farm up and set up and ready to go. So here's our warm standby architecture. We've got our production environment on the left, and we've got our farm in Azure on the right-hand side. I've plugged in a standard architecture here, a standard topology. I don't want you to worry too much about the topology. It should work. The solution should work with any of our supported topologies. What I would like to focus on is this bottom layer here where we're using log shipping and DFSR, which is distributed file system replication, to move the database files from the on-premises environment up into Azure. So the solution that we have just published guidance to TechNet on is about setting up log shipping in DFSR and about building this environment. I want to let you know, though, that we are announcing support at this conference for using SQL Always On asynchronously. That's Neil Hodgkinson, his session, which is the same time as this session. If you're interested in this, you can look back on his session and look at his slide deck. So just want to let you know that is an option. My team does work with Neil, and he has assured me that even if you choose to use Always On asynchronously instead of log shipping, that everything I'm presenting to you still applies. So here's that architecture laid out across the Azure infrastructure. It's the same architecture I just walked through a few minutes ago with the addition of this file share on the right-hand side. We chose to put the file share in the cloud service with the databases. The file share is playing a double duty role here. It's also serving as the third node of a node majority for the SQL Always On availability group, and this is our recommended configuration. I want to let you know, here's a tip from the field. This comes from Sanjay, who presented on Azure earlier this week. He suggested if you're concerned about high availability of the logs and you don't want to go to the trouble of configuring HA across two file shares, you could consider using a new feature in Azure, the Windows Azure Blob Storage Service. This feature saves logs directly to a blob storage URL, so you could use that instead of the file share solution. We have not tested this. We might, but we haven't currently tested this, so this is not included in our content on TechNet, but it's documented in this article. There's a link there, and it's certainly an option for you. One thing to note, when you add this file share to the solution, don't put it in the availability set with those two database servers, because that will really mess up your high availability plan. It will make your picture look really nice, but not good for HA. So let's talk a little bit about the recovery environment and what the process looks like. So the disaster recovery farm in Azure, we want it to look as identical as possible to the on-premises farm. I've already mentioned it can be a much smaller version of that farm, but every role you have deployed in your production farm, you want to have that represented in your Azure farm. Ideally, you have the same configuration of customizations in both farms. So in this scenario, the logs are replayed to the Azure-based SQL servers, but they're just going to sit there until after you do failover or when you do a failover exercise. Here's what recovery looks like. This is kind of high level in a nutshell. We're going to attach the content databases. At this point, your sites and your content are available. You could make that available to your users. Next, we're going to restore services. In our solution, we've taken a very practical approach. We're not restoring search. We're just going to recrawl. It's a very practical, it's a less complex solution. And then update the DNS records if you haven't already. Here's what a cold standby environment looks like. So looking at the illustration, on the left side, we've got the running VMs, and on the right side, we've got VMs that you can shut down. So among the running VMs are the two VMs that are collecting the logs, the file share and one of the SQL servers. The rest of the environment can be shut down. When you do a failover exercise, bring all those VMs up and running, and once you have that second SQL server set up, the additional step here for a cold environment is to configure the always on after the failover. And then operationally, if you're doing a cold environment, you do need to plan for every once in a while starting the environment up, refreshing the IP configuration, making sure those VMs are patched and updated and ready to go. So a bit more information on restoring services. Here's how I want you to think about it. Any service with a database, we're going to restore that service by creating the service application after failover, and in that process, specifying the database that was log shipped as the database you're going to use for the service. We've got a great example in our TechNet content of how to do this with a managed metadata service. There are a couple services for which it makes no sense to go to the bother of restoring from a log shipped database, and these are listed here. That's the usage and health data collection service, the state service, and word automation. Just start them. And then, of course, any service that does not have a database associated with this, just kick it off and get it going. So let's talk about search. In our solution, like I said, we took a very practical, kind of low-cost approach. We're not restoring from the search databases. We're simply making sure that we have the components configured and ready to go in the Azure environment, and then kicking off a full crawl. We know that some of our customers have compelling business needs for true search restore scenarios, and I want to let you know that we have some content coming soon to support you there. So Neil Hodgkinson has worked with our search team in Oslo to define some scenarios that we'll recommend and to come up with the process of how to accomplish the restore. Purely for reference, this slide is a list of the service applications, and you can easily see which ones have databases associated with them. So now that you have your disaster recovery environment all designed, you've deployed it, it's ready to go, it is not time to relax. A successful recovery environment depends on a really solid operations plan. So here's some top-of-mind things for my team. We want to make sure you keep the environment patched and updated, develop a process and a procedure for maintaining that environment. We want you to test the failover process. This is so important. Test failover on a regular basis, whatever that is going to mean for you. This ensures that your team knows what to do and how to do it, and it also ensures that your environment in Azure remains viable. And then finally, the DNS settings. We want you to work with your networking team ahead of time to identify the DNS records that are affected and come up with a plan for how those are going to be updated in the event of a failover. So my team built a proof of concept environment on campus. We have built an on-premises farm, connected that up to Windows Azure. And we've learned a few things. We're going to be publishing even more, but here are a few top-of-mind things, and these actually apply to any SharePoint environment in Azure. The first kind of big takeaway I want you to have here is to design the Azure-based environment before you create VMs. So my team, we wanted to make some changes to the cloud services based on what we learned, and in order to do so, we ended up throwing away a whole set of VMs and starting over, and I don't want you to have to do that. We also ran into some time sync issues between the Azure environment and the on-premises environment. So the recommendation is to be aware that that's a possibility and to follow the best practices for monitoring and managing time sync issues. And then finally, this last point, this is a best practice that comes from our Azure team, and it is to look at your architecture, identify the VM size that's the largest one you need for your solution. When you start to deploy VMs, do that one first. So go ahead and create the largest VM size you need. It might be your SQL Server. You don't need to configure it, just set it aside. But what this does is it ensures that your solution lands in a stamp in Azure that supports all of the sizes that you need. If you don't do this, what happens, Kirk?
Performance can be slightly degraded. So again, our recommended approach is go ahead and add the biggest virtual machine first, and that's going to make sure that. And for more information, you can go to one of Mark Rusinovich's sessions, or you can even view online where we've recorded those, where he talks about performance implications and best practices.
So I know in our case, we ran into the issue where we created the smallest one first, and then when it came time to create the largest one, Windows Azure didn't let us because we weren't in a place in the data center that supported that largest size. So Mark Rusinovich promises this won't be an issue forever, but for now it is, so it's a best practice. All right, so my team has just published a lot of content to TechNet for this solution. We've got a solution model, which is a big Visio diagram, and with any of our Visios, you know, the primary purpose is to publish it out there so you can copy and paste that architecture and have something to start with. We don't want you to have to start from scratch when you design your environments. And then we have a nice long article that actually talks about designing the environment, how it works, configuring log shipping. For the first time, we have log shipping content for SharePoint, and then the other aspects of disaster recovery. We plan to add more to this article and more to this content set, so we welcome your feedback. We've always got a link in our TechNet articles where you can give us feedback. So just to wrap up our disaster recovery conversation, my team built a POC. We have this nice solution. It's actually based on the process that was used in our SharePoint Online dedicated environment, but it's adapted for Azure. And it's a basic solution. It's a very practical solution. After failover, what you get with this solution are sites and content. You get search, it's recrawled, and then you get your services. There are some other things you could add to a disaster recovery solution. These are things that are worth talking about. You can certainly hire a Microsoft consulting person or one of our partners or MVPs and have the conversation about these items. That includes synchronizing the custom farm solutions. Connections to data sources that are back on premises. I'm not sure that that's going to be practical for all of our customers. Maybe it's a compelling need for you. Certainly have that conversation. And then have the conversation about search restore scenarios. Do you actually need a more robust search scenario? And then finally, this last point is a point you should really kick off your exercise with and your planning with. Talk about your recovery time objectives and your recovery point objectives. Answering these questions will help you guide you down the path of whether you need warm, cold, or hot standby and help you make some of the other finer decisions that need to go into your design.
I'm really excited to talk about this next part. I had a lot of fun working with Brenda and the team starting around early December. And I made the flippant remark whenever we said, oh yeah, we'll put internet sites in Azure. And I told you what, I'd bake maybe a day, two.
Yeah.
I've been working on it for about 6-7 months. And there were some interesting lessons.
It feels like 6 or 7 months.
It does. So 6 or 7 months. Nice math, Kirk. So we're going to talk about not only the lessons learned, but also we're going to give you some prescriptive guidance about how to do public-facing internet sites with Windows Azure. And the reason why this is so compelling is because a lot of customers, there we are, got to be close to it. A lot of customers have challenges with putting public-facing internet sites in their network infrastructure, challenges with domain controllers and uncomfortableness with putting domain controllers for a public-facing internet site. A lot of customers have these challenges. So we're going to see that this actually solves not only that challenge, but a couple of other ones, because as we said, we really want you to start with Office 365. It is the most compelling scenario. However, public-facing internet sites with Office 365, not all features are currently implemented that you might need for that type of solution. Therefore, either hosting it on-premises or, if you find that challenging, Azure actually provides a really compelling solution for that. Another really nice part of this is that this can now enable you to scale out and in much more easily because you don't have the capital expense of having to provision hardware. When you need a new server on premises, that means you typically have to go procure a new server, and we all know that that's not a one-day exercise in most organizations. This can take several months I've heard customers, it takes them almost a year not only to allocate budgeting, but also go through provisioning. So the nice thing is that you can simply go in and add new virtual machines to your environment, but also you can easily remove them as well. And that's an important distinction because we also mentioned auto-scale. Auto-scale has the promise of automatically doing this for you. However, we all know that when you add a new server to SharePoint, that it's not simply adding a server, you also need to register it with configuration database. That's why we have to run the configuration wizard. Autoscale would never do something like that for you. It doesn't manage the internals. It simply spins up new VMs. Therefore, it's really not an appropriate solution for SharePoint. So now, what we decided was to take the medium internet sites farm example from TetNet and use that as the basis of the proof of concept. And what our goals were, we wanted to get roughly about 85 page views per second, and we actually achieved that. We measured that through automated load testing. And we also were able to issue roughly about 100 queries per second. And this matches the content in TechNet. Whenever they said, if you use this architecture, this should be roughly the performance that you expect, and it was roughly the performance that we achieved.
So there's a link to the model if you want to go get more information about this architecture.
So if we're going to build the medium farm in Windows Azure, some things to really consider. First, I brought up that concept of the domain controller and the uncomfortableness that some customers have with exposing their domain controller for that public-facing internet site. And one of the nice things here is that in the diagram, we discussed how you can use the VPN connection to be able to extend your domain controller infrastructure into Windows Azure. But that's completely optional. You don't have to do this part. In fact, I'd say one of the most valuable parts of the solution is the fact that I can create a standalone forest or domain controller and out in Azure and use that for SharePoint, and it would be completely isolated from my internal resources. And so this helps solve that problem of, do I extend? Can I use a read-only domain controller? And hopefully everybody understands the challenges that SharePoint has with read-only domain controllers. So what we decided to do was to not use the on-premises Active Directory infrastructure. Instead, we completely use a standalone isolated identity solution. The other thing to consider is, we mentioned this very briefly before, about availability sets, how the way that Windows Azure works is when you define an availability set, multiple roles will then participate in that availability set. And to make this really easy, if you're going to deploy that SharePoint in your environment, you're probably going to have two web front ends. That way, if one goes down, the other one's available. You would not put both of those on the same server, because then if you lose power to the server, that defeats the purpose. You'd put them on two different servers. Availability set tells Azure to make sure that those are put in different fault domains. So taking this a step further, Azure says if you have three servers in the same fault domain, in the same availability set, it will have no more than, if you have three, two out of the three could actually go down and not be two of the three could be in the same fault domain. That's what I was trying to espouse. Sorry about that. Let me try that one more time, friends. If we have three servers, two of them could possibly be in the same fault domain. Looking at this diagram, then you can see that that could be a specific challenge, because if you carefully place all of the different services on different machines, but they're in the same availability set, that could say that if two of these three go down, we could lose, we could lose analytics. That would be bad. We could lose the admin component. That would definitely be bad. So what you're going to need to do is make sure that you have all components provisioned to all roles within that same availability set. And this is going to affect your architecture a little bit and also make you think, maybe if I have a search-intensive solution, maybe that requires a different cloud service with a different availability set. So now let's talk about identity. At the Ask the Experts last night, this was probably the hottest, most debated topic. First, can I use SQL Azure for my databases instead of provisioning my own database? And the answer is, unfortunately, we're not there yet. We still require your own SQL database to be provisioned in a virtual machine in the cloud. Okay, but you have this other great thing called Windows Azure Active Directory. Can I just use that instead of my own domain controller in the cloud? And again, the answer is we're not there yet. Hopefully one day that will become a reality. I'm not saying that's even on the roadmap now. What I'm saying is right now we require you to have your own domain controller. That domain controller would be used for the machine accounts, for the service accounts, such as the farm account itself, the search account. You'll want those accounts to be in your own domain controller. But the users themselves don't have to go through Active Directory. For that, what you can do is use SAML claims, a trusted identity provider, and that's the role that Windows Azure AD would provide. You could have your users stored in Windows Azure AD, and I'll show a demonstration of how to do that here in just a moment. So with Active Directory, kind of going through this point by point, first is, yes, you need a dedicated domain controller in Azure. You don't want to even try to just use your on-premises AD. The latency there would cause performance issues. You need a domain controller closely located to SharePoint, which means you need to provision one in Azure. Also, the accounts for site developers and authors, they can authenticate, and here's where you could maybe stretch your Active Directory infrastructure across using site-to-site VPN connectivity, or you could have that standalone Active Directory that I talked about previously. And further, we could enable then our customers and partners to use Windows Azure Active Directory. So site authors internally would be able to still authenticate using Active Directory, either replicated or a standalone environment. And our partners then could also possibly authenticate with Windows Azure AD. Which brings up the next challenge, zones. How would you then use a multi-zone architecture with the understanding that Microsoft is also recommending you to use one web application with multiple site collections? And this brings up some interesting challenges. Because the way that we would approach this is you would have a default zone. And for the default zone, the site developers and authors, the internal users, would then be able to authenticate to Active Directory, and then they would develop content. The visitors and customers would then be able to either access a different zone anonymously, because you'll want that different zone to enable anonymous, where the default zone may not have anonymous. And then we might have a third zone. Now, the two zones that I talked about already were basically HTTP, that I could have HTTP. And you probably want HTTP for that public-facing internet site for the anonymous users, therefore not requiring SSL. But for those authenticated users that are using Windows Azure AD or another trusted identity provider, that requires SSL. So there's a requirement for a third zone, which has different authentication requirements and also uses a different protocol. So we have the default zone, can be HTTP for the internal site users. The internet zone could be used for our partner or for anonymous users. And the extranet zone could be used for SSL secured using a trusted identity provider for those third-party users.
So we tried a few different configurations with zones, and this is what we know works.
I have some more prescriptive guidance coming up in a further slide. This is the thing that caused us a significant amount of time. So cross-site publishing. There's a new feature in SharePoint 2013 called cross-site publishing. And one of the really nice things about it is that I can have maybe assets defined in one site collection, and that might be all of the images that will be stored for my public-facing internet site. A different site collection that might be all of the metadata and information that also links to those assets, and that could allow me to then publish that content as a catalog. And then third, we can have another one that would be our publishing site that would consume that catalog. Well, here's some challenges with this. The cross-site publishing, whenever you publish that content, only works with the default zone. But we have multiple authentication requirements requiring multiple zones and multiple protocol requirements requiring multiple zones. That limitation of not being able to use more than the default zone actually caused some issues in trying to stand up the proof of concept. And as well as working with our great support team and trying to ensure that that there was an opportunity for them to at least understand that this was a challenge. And our feedback is that the workaround for this is that cross-site publishing would only be available in the default zone. But the asset site collection now can have multiple URLs, and the publishing site can also have multiple URLs. And I'll show you how to do that using a new PowerShell commandlet in SharePoint 2013 that's called set SP site URL. So here I am on my virtual machine that's out in the cloud. I just remote desktop into the virtual machine. And I want to start by pointing out that I have one web application with, if I go into authentication providers with multiple zones. The default zone, internet zone, extranet zone. Let's go look at the default zone and look at the settings. Default zone does not enable anonymous access because that's where our site users and authors, the internal users, will authenticate. And since our internal users are authenticating, we're going to use Windows authentication. Let's go look at another zone. Let's look at the internet zone. And you can imagine this one, of course, would have enable anonymous access. So enabling those external users to access this content anonymously. You still require authentication. Every zone requires at least one authentication type. So I left the default of using Windows authentication, and then you could simply remove the sign-in link from the page as you brand that site. The last zone would be our extranet. The extranet does not enable anonymous access. And you can see a new trusted identity provider. And this is our link out to Windows Azure Active Directory. So the experience then would be for those anonymous users, they access through port 80, they'd be able to access content anonymously. Site authors would then need to go to another zone. So let's see how we set all this up. I'm going to open up PowerShell. This is not a developer session. This is IT Pro. I expect IT pros to become familiar with PowerShell if you aren't already. Hopefully this is not new to you. So I'm seeing everybody kind of nod, yeah, I'm already familiar with PowerShell. Good. I love to hear this. So you'll start by setting up a new SP authentication provider. And then from there, we'll set up a new web application. I named it HNSC, just as you saw in Central Admin a moment ago, and I gave it a non-standard port. The reason for the non-standard port is because I don't want to use port 80 here. I'm going to use port 80 in a different zone. So for this zone, I'm using a non-standard port that enables those internal users to be able to access and log in. I provide a URL, such as SP all-in-one, which is the name of the machine. I provide the authentication provider and its application pool. Also say, here's the application pool account, the database, that stuff. Then we extend it. So we're going to extend it to a second zone. This is the same as if you go into Central Admin and you go to the web application and you say extend it. I'm just showing you how to extend via PowerShell instead of Central Admin. When we extend it, I'm going to give it a name, HNSC Internet, tell it the zone, the port. And there's that port 80. We need port 80 for the internet zone. So that's why I use the non-standard port for the default zone. We'll give it a URL. We can be the same URL here. And we allow anonymous access. Then we extend one more time, extranet. And in the extranet, we'll see that we allow port 443. So that's our SSL. Okay, so that sets the stage for the different zones. And I imagine at this point, there's some people like, please move faster, I know this part. But it's important to understand that these zones are going to be used for different security zones. A quick question? So for those who couldn't hear, the question was, on the previous screen, I had two identity providers, Windows and also a SAML claims provider. Any reason that I did that? And simply for demonstration purposes here in just a moment to show I could enable that scenario if I wanted to, but it's completely up to you that you can have that zone have just claims auth. It doesn't not require Windows. Okay, so the next part that we want to walk through is how did we then provision the site collections? I'm showing here very briefly for additional reference where we set up the super user and the super reader, and those accounts will need access to the object cache. And to do that, we'll use the claims identity. Notice, though, that we're not setting those users up as Windows Azure Active Directory users. These are actually Active Directory domain servers, ADDS users. But it's using the claims format. So these are actually users from from an actual domain controller Active Directory. And this is, again, important. This is one of those accounts that cannot come from Windows Azure AD. Must be from your domain controller. Next, I'm going to scroll down a little bit. And you'll start by creating a new empty site collection, the root path-based site. So this one's pretty easy. New SP site, new site collection, nothing to look at here. I tell it to use the port 8000. And when you provision a new site collection, it's provisioned into the default zone. Now let's go look here. And I created another one. And this is the product catalog site collection. This one, I'm using hostname site collections. Using hostname site collections allows me to give a different URL to the site collection that's different from the web application itself. So I give a hostname site collection URL. And now I'm going to go down to the publishing site collection. This is the public-facing internet site. First, we're going to say new SP site, and we'll give it a hostname site collection URL. Then we'll use these two new commandlets in SharePoint 2013, set SP site URL. Site URL is going to allow me to provide a different URL for the same site collection, but tell it what's the zone. So let's move over and look at the zone. Where we tell it, blueskyabove.us will be in the internet zone. Secure blueskyaboveus will be in the extranet zone. Again, so this is important to know that when I show you the demo here in just a second, when we log in, that you're actually going to authenticate into those different zones. The last part I want to point out is this part, the asset site collection. The asset site collection is where we'll store all the images and everything that will be used for our public-facing internet site. But this guy right here, the internal users can authenticate and author content. External, our partners, we don't want them doing anything with this in this design. We could absolutely enable that. But in this design, I simply want to make sure that it's available to anonymous users. So we're going to go over here, look and see that I say, give me the site collection, assets. Oh, I did not mean to copy that. Assets, corp, contoso.com. We're going to give it the SP site URL of assets, blue sky above US, and it'll be available on the internet zone. Then finally, we're at the problem child, the publishing catalog. And the content that's being published itself, the product catalog, again, is only available in the default zone. So now let's show the login experience real quick. First, let's go to the browser, and we'll go to www.blueskyabove.us. You can hit that from your tablets right now, your Surface that everybody's carrying around, so we appreciate you being Surface customers. It's Surface 2. So you'll be able to log into this. See, it's a public-facing internet site, www.blueskyabove.us. Since I configured the object cache accounts, I was also able to provide caching. So you can see that it's a heavily branded site that uses all the new SEO features and all the new managed search and navigation features, content by search. I can go in and look at cameras, look at just digital cameras. I can go in, and it's extremely responsive. And the reason why is because I configured all caching, object caching, and also the site collection caching, and I set up different profiles for those. Now let's go back and log in. Remember, my intention here is not to have this. I left it here. You can brand this and remove this. There's no reason to keep this around. The zone requires you to have authentication, and SharePoint automatically provides a sign-in link for you, but you can remove it in your solution. If I'm going to log in, though, I'm going to go over here to secure blueskyabove.us. And I'm going to, just as a quick demonstration, show how I could log in using Windows authentication. I'm going to log in with Windows off. And there you go. Just like we all log in as the farm account. There we go, right there. So I'm logged in as the farm account just to prove. I could have logged in as a real user, but it's just a good joke. So the next part that we'll do is you get this, right? You get that I just was able to log into SharePoint using Windows off. Now, let me show you one other part that's cool. Because I'm going to go into a system account and say sign out. Notice that because, it's all right, pay no attention to the man up front. We'll go up here and desktop, and this is why I pre-record demos, ladies and gentlemen. There was a guy the other day that gave me feedback that said he was very unhappy that all of my demos were pre-recorded. This is why. So you're seeing a live demo just for that guy. All right, ACS provider, there we go. So now, since I have two of them registered and I'm using a trusted identity provider, trusted identity provider allows me to go in and log in. Log in as blueskyabove.us, and look at this beautiful experience because I'm now using Windows Azure AD. I'll show you how to set this up in a subsequent demo. Just to prove that I can log in. If I can remember my password in front of a live audience. No, fail. Which one is it? There it is. Oh, nice. Okay, this is good because what it's saying is I happen to accidentally log in with my Office 365 account. But I have a different account. Again, why I pre-record demos. All right, we're going to say admin at Blue Sky Above. This is a different directory that I have. Wait for it, wait for it. Which password is it, Kirk? Thank you. They're clapping because I remember my password. All right, so we're going to say admin at Blue Sky Above on Microsoft.com, proving that I am logged in with a trusted identity provider, and I'm logged in a different zone. Now, on Monday's session, I also pointed out some of the different things that I did with how did I do routing, how did I www.blueskyaboveus, how did I make that publicly available, and just really quick, one thing I want to point out, I'm not going to go in deep, please go back and you can review the material from SPC 298 later. But at this point, what I really want to show first is we go back to the management portal, and we will go back to the management portal, and we go to the cloud service itself. We go to the cloud service, notice that it gives us a URL for the cloud service of spvms.cloudapp.net, cloudapp.net. So now I can go back and run PowerShell really quick and show you a neat trick, because what I did is I went to my public domain registrar, in my case is register.com, and I actually added a CNAME alias. So if I go to blueskyabove.us, you'll see actually what it's pointing to is my domain is blueskyabove.us, but it's CNAME alias to spvms.cloudapp.net. So you'll need to add a CNAME alias that points to your cloud service, and therefore that's how the traffic finds your cloud service. Therefore, SharePoint picks it up, knows that it's www.blueskyabove.us, routes it to the correct zone, the correct site collection, therefore we get the rendered content. Good, all right? So the last thing that I want to show about the public-facing internet sites is just really quickly the ability that I could not only access everything, I accessed this from my Windows 8 machine, and I was accessing all of that content. So you could actually go to secure.blueskyabove.us, and you would see the same login. I'm not going to give you credentials today, but you could actually see the little drop-down and see that that works. But if I'm an internal user, I might want to use the site VPN, and I might want to have to go to like http://publishing.contoso.com on that non-standard port, and I would have the ability for that user to go in, start authoring content here. The external partner could then come in and finish authoring content, and then could continue along. Okay. So I talked briefly about using Azure AD. And again, we cannot just remove Active Directory domain services from the equation. We have to, if we're going to use Windows Azure AD, it's simply for the users. Right? We're going to store our users out there in Windows Azure AD, and then we're going to use that as the base for the trusted identity provider. Windows Azure AD only speaks SAML 2. SharePoint only speaks SAML 1.1. We have a communication gap. We need to fill that. There's some different ways you can fill that. You could use ADFS, or it turns out that we have a really nice component out in the cloud. It's called Windows Azure ACS. You've probably heard this term a few times this week, talking about Office 365 and the authentication and applications and how all that works. So with Windows Azure ACS, this is going to provide that translation layer between SAML 2, SAML 1.1, that makes SharePoint happy. So how to set this up? I'm going to show you. This is for reference to you to take home later to remember the steps. There's a few steps.
We've got a great article published to TechNet last week that gives you the blow-by-blow with lots of screen captures, too.
Yep.
From Kirk's environment.
Yes. So the first thing you'll need to do is download the Windows Azure Active Directory PowerShell module. And this will give you this new commandlet, new MSOL service principle. What this guy's going to do is register with Azure ACS here in Windows Azure AD. Here's my ACS trust, and it's going to establish a trust between these two, ACS and Azure AD, for your tenant. And next, we'll set up a service principle name. And using that service principle, we'll provide the endpoint for our ACS instance. And then we'll also say what's the display name and the address for the reply URL. And then hopefully this PowerShell looks familiar. I'm keeping this here just for your reference. This is setting up any claims provider in SharePoint 2013. It turns out it's the same exact PowerShell you would have done if you're using ADFS. So instead of showing PowerShell on a PowerPoint slide, I prefer the demo. Okay, so I'm going to first go over to PowerShell. I'm going to show you a few things here. First, import module MS Online Extended dash Force. Did that twice. I'm going to tell it the reply URL will be the return of new MSOL service principal addresses. And our address will be bluesky.above.accesscontrol.windows.net. The service principal will be it will have a service principal names, as well as display name and the address. Now, where in the world did I get this value right here? That's a great question. Let me answer that for you. We're going to go into Windows Azure, into Windows Azure Management Portal. And we're going to scroll down and first show you Active Directory, where I've already created a directory here called Blue Sky Above. And I open that up, and I have users. And in those users, I have, there's myself, there's the admin, there's lovely Ms. Brenda Carter, also Mr. Reza Ali. So I have some users that are available in my directory. I could also have groups. I could register applications. I could do dir-sync. And I could also configure additional information, such as if I'm going to use the new Active Directory Premium, where I could brand that login experience. So I set up the directory, but then I also went to this other thing called access control namespaces. Access control namespaces, you simply create new, and you tell it that you want an access control namespace, quick create, and I'll just tell it this is awesome demo. But I'm not going to create that. Oh, I'm surprised that that's not already taken. So we'll go back and just, that's how easy it is to create the access control namespace. Once you create it, then we'll choose down here at the bottom, this guy right here, manage. So we'll say manage. And this is going to let you log in. And we're taken back to 1980s web development. And here's where we would register our identity provider. Register an identity provider, and I told it two identity providers. There's my Blue Sky Above, which is going to use WS Federation, or Windows Live ID, which uses Live ID. So I would see this Blue Sky Above after I register the new MSOL service principal. That's where it would show up. So I say, here's my identity provider. I could add a new identity provider, and I could say that I want a WS Federation identity provider here. Or I could do Facebook, I could do Google, I could do Yahoo, and then I'm just going to cancel out real quick. So my identity provider that I created, Blue Sky Above US, whenever I added it, there were a couple steps that I needed to do to add this in. Let's open it up and show you those steps. First, I gave it a display name. Second, I needed to go here and provide this URL. So let's go to Notepad, blow this up so you can read it. Format font, bump that way up for the cheap seats in the back. There we go. Accounts.accesscontrol.windows.net. That's going to be the URL that you'll start with. Then the name of your domain, Blue Sky Above, on Microsoft.com/Federation Metadata 2007-06, Federation Metadata XML. And now why I'm pointing all of this out is because you'll need to go through these same steps. And if we go look at this XML document, ooh, that's pretty. Because it includes this information here called its signature. And that signature has an X509 cert. And the X509 cert could be used to simply copy the entire contents here. Copy, go back to Notepad, paste. Look at how easy that is to read. I got a groan in the front of the audience. That's awesome. All right, so we'll go back here and we'll do file save as. And let's go into ctemp, ctemp. And then I could say here and change it to all files. And I could say this is my ACS token signing cert dot CER. So what I'm doing is saving the contents of this as a dot CER. And you can imagine then, oh, he's getting the token signing certificate. And this is one trick to do that. Another one, ACS will allow you to create a self-signed cert if you want, upload it. There's a couple of options. We've documented that in the white paper. Okay, so the last part of it, once I have the cert, and I've already set up the identity provider, now I'm going to go back to here and say, there's a couple of settings that I need to add, such as that's what I'm looking for, the token signing certificate. And you can see there's the X509 cert. And now once I've created the identity provider, now I need to create a relying party application. The relying party application, SPVMs, cloudapp.net, or there's my secure blueskyabove.us. Let's open that guy up. A couple things I want to point out. First, you give it a realm, like URN, SharePoint, Blue Sky Above. I usually recommend use a URN instead of a URL. It's easy to remember that this is really just an identifier. Second part is what's the return URL. If you've done trusts with SharePoint 2013, you'll recognize that underscore trust, that guy right there. You'll need that. And that tells ACS to return back to that SharePoint endpoint. And the last part, token format is SAML 1.1. And we'll need to tell it the token lifetime. By default, it's going to say 600, which happens to be the same timeout for the SharePoint token as well. And you'll get an interesting scenario where if they both time out at the same time, you'll get this bounce back effect between them until finally one gives up. So what you want to do is change one of them. It's a lot easier to change it here than it is in SharePoint. So just go here, change it to a different number like 700. Once we've done that, we're going to rule groups. We're going to rule groups, and I'll just say add a new rule group, and I could say foo, ASDF, save, whatever. And then I could say that I want to generate some rules. And the rules would be for Blue Sky Above US, generate. And that's just going to pass through all of the rules over to SharePoint. All claims are simply passed through. But there's a problem. I'm going to just delete this one real quick. If I go back to the default rule group, you can see there's this one that I custom built called name claim to UPN, because the UPN by default is not passed through. And we're going to need the UPN to uniquely identify the user. So I'm going to look and see in the UPN, I set up a rule that simply copies the value from one to the other, to the UPN. Again, this is documented in the white paper that we just released from this environment and shows how to do this. The last part to the puzzle is we go to the trusted identity issuer and we set up a new SP trusted identity issuer. We then say, set up a new SP trusted root authority using the certificate, the signing certificate that we just used a moment ago. We set up our claim type mappings pointing to, there's the UPN, also given name and surname. Finally, we're going to use the realm. There's that URN that I pointed out a moment ago. create a new SP trusted token issuer using those values. And then finally, we could add additional realms because we're using hostname site collections. So we add additional hostname site collections. We might want them to also participate here. This is how you would add those additional hostname site collections to the part to that trusted provider by adding additional realms. You also saw the final step was the ability for me to then securely log in using HTTPS secure.blueskyabove.us, logged in as that user from Windows Azure Active Directory. Quick question? The question was, if you set up two trusted providers, what are you going to see? And what you would see here is first you would choose the authentication mechanism, which one of your providers. So if you had an additional provider, it would show up right here. And next is because this authentication is the web application level, not at the site collection level. So any site collections using that zone, using all those trusted identity providers in that zone, would then be able to use that as your authentication, which reinforces my point previously of why we use multiple zones. Each one had a different authentication requirement. So to wrap up, internet sites and our lessons learned. First, that trick about the CNAME, that took me roughly a couple hours of Bing and trying to search, and finally when I saw a reference, I was like, oh, it's that easy. Little bits of time saved, that's the value we're trying to add to you. Second, you can't add additional NICs in Azure. Azure, you get one NIC and it uses DHCP. That's gonna bring some interesting challenges when you're doing like multiple web applications and trying to use SSL, because each SSL web application might require to use different IPs. A way around that is maybe to use server name indication to be able to use based on different host headers, or the way that we used it was a wildcard cert based on that one web application, all hostname site collections using the wildcard cert. This default zone thing threw me for a significant amount of time. The publishing site and that default site, first turns out that when you create the web application, you can't create it as HTTPS first and then extend it to HTTP. SharePoint gets sick and says, file not found. You have to create it as HTTP first and then extend it to HTTPS. It seems like a little thing, but imagine the steps that it takes to provision the web application and how long that usually takes. This was several hours lost just with that one little weird thing. So saving the little bits of time, that's the value you pay for a SharePoint conference. And finally, the cross-site publishing default zone only thing also threw me for a significant amount of time. So you want to watch, if you're going to use content publishing catalogs, make sure that you understand that it only works in the default zone. Additional things that you'll need to think about are things like with claims, people picker issues. People picker issues still are going to be present here. And further, you'll probably need to write a custom claim provider to provide that fill search and fill resolve capabilities. And finally, user profile sync. There's no way to do user profile sync to talk directly to Windows Azure AD. You're going to probably have to write some custom components there as well.
Sure, we just published a bunch of content to TechNet about our Azure-based solutions, and we have content to support our internet site solution. We've got two models. One is a design sample that you can just lift and plug in your own URLs. The other one is a solution model, which provides an overview of the design process of the stuff that we've talked to you today about. And then we've got a couple of articles, including the bottom article, which is actually how to configure the SharePoint farm to use Windows Azure Active Directory.
We have some related sessions to point you to. I did the introduction to SharePoint and Windows Azure IaaS, where I walked through in more detail how do you do things like setting up the CNAME, and then how does the routing work, what is a disk, how to think about disks, and how to actually architect your SharePoint solution using those multiple disks. We didn't really cover that today because we're more about the solution side, not the starting implementation. Second, SharePoint Business Continuity Management. If you're really interested in DR and are interested in SQL Server Always On, then Neil Hodgson gave a fantastic presentation on that. Actually, I'm sorry, is giving one at this time. So thank you for being here. And you can go back and see Neil's content as well. Finally, deploying highly available SharePoint Internet sites and Windows Azure Virtual Machines, Luca Bandinelli from our SharePoint Customer Advisory Team, as well as Sanjay Nirang, a senior consultant from MCS, gave a fantastic talk on that. That's at 10:40. That was at 10:45 on Tuesday. And then finally, automated SharePoint 2013 disaster recovery using Windows Azure and Cloud Paks. We put an enormous amount of time into building this content. The amount of time that it took to not only build the environment, prove it out, but make sure that the content that Brendan, the content team, was writing was accurate. This is one of the things we've heard the feedback that TechNet articles were the gaps. We made sure that we had not just us, but an entire team of people reviewing this content, making sure that it was as accurate as possible. The amount of work that came in for us to be able to deliver this to you, we hope that you'll give us all fives. Anything less, please come talk to me first and let's talk about that before you fill out your evals. With that, I am extremely happy to be here today to finally deliver this content and guidance we've been working on so hard. Thank you for coming to SharePoint Conference. Have a great rest of the conference.